hold life and death over those companies. I don't think it would be proper for me to take money from them. Personally, Strother agreed. But he told his client that this was, quote, how all the other senators do it now.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. When President Obama was on the campaign trail, he promised that he would change the culture of Washington. And a deeply ingrained part of that culture is the business of lobbying. In his new book, So Damn Much Money, The Triumph of Lobbying and the Corrosion of American Government, veteran Washington Post reporter and editor Robert Kaiser takes readers into the world of lobbying through the story of a modern-day Great Gatsby named Jack Cassidy. After a difficult and impoverished childhood, Cassidy came to Washington with idealistic ideas about helping the poor. After founding one of the most successful and profitable lobbying firms in the nation's capital, Cassidy was a multimillionaire with plenty of influence in the halls of Congress. In his book, Kaiser uses his keen understanding of the ways of Washington to reveal how influence peddling and politics have become inextricably entwined in the halls of our government. Kaiser discussed his new book, So Damn Much Money, at the Politics and Prose bookstore on February 4th, 2009.
Thank you very much. It's daunting to have so many friends in the audience. If I screw up, it's going to be serious. The occasions like this offer a good challenge to an author who has written an ambitious book, and I've done that. Explain it in 20 minutes, and oh yes, make it sound irresistible. I'll do my best. So Damn Much Money is my attempt to explain what happened here in our town, my hometown, in the last third of the 20th century and the first years of the 21st, when our politics descended into the toilet. I've used lobbying and the career of one interesting but little-known lobbyist, Jerry Cassidy, who Carla mentioned, a man who's accumulated a fortune of at least $100 million by playing the Washington game extremely well. I've used Cassidy and his career as a kind of governing metaphor in the book. It's one of two storylines that I've tried to weave together. The second one recounts how politics, as Carl just described, have been transformed by money and technology. Here's my argument in a nutshell. By the time the voters woke up in 2006 and 2008 and ended the Bush era, Washington was badly broken, a real mess. The mess took nearly four decades to create. It was a joint effort. Democrats and Republicans collaborated to create it. Over the last 40 years, I argue, American politics really were transformed. It was a complex process, but its essence is pretty easy to describe. Television and money changed everything. Television is shorthand for the new technologies that came into use in our electoral politics starting in the late 60s. By the early 80s, polling, focus groups, television commercials made by highly paid consultants, slick direct mail, all these had taken over our campaigns. The commercials and the direct mail were most often based on the findings of the pollsters, who went out to learn what was on people's minds so that the politicians could pander to them. Here's one of my most favorite statistics that I uncovered in my reporting for this book. In 1989, several academics surveyed dozens of political consultants and asked them a simple question: what role did your candidate play in deciding what issues would be raised in his or her campaign? 44% said the candidate had left it to the consultant to decide what to emphasize. 68% said the candidate left all the tactical decisions also to the consultant. Think about that. Here's another favorite from 1988. This came from a project that we did when I was the national news editor of the Post in the late 80s, and we did a project then. We realized that this new technology of politics had come and was really important. And David Broder went to see his old friend, Doug Bailey. Many of you here know the name. Doug is still, happily, very much alive, a moderate Republican, a Clifford Case Republican. Older people here may remember what that means. It means a Republican from a defunct Republican Party, as Bailey is himself. But David went to Doug and said, you know, what's going on here? And Bailey said this, quote, "The biggest problem is that it's no longer necessary for a political candidate to guess what an audience thinks. He can do that with a nightly tracking poll. So it's no longer likely that political leaders are going to lead. Instead, they're going to follow." 1988. Think about it. An absolutely prescient observation, in my opinion. Bailey was describing the dawning of the age of pandering, an age that everybody in this room has been living through for quite a while. Now, who would want to run for office in these conditions is a problem I think we haven't thought enough about. One obvious answer: attractive, well-spoken men and women who can raise the money needed to pay for the modern campaign, an amount that has gone up steadily every 2 years since 1974, and who are willing to and able to follow their pollsters and consultants' directions. Would these be statesmen? Not likely. One of my conclusions, which I argue out in the book, is that we have many fewer really smart and independent people in Congress today than we had when I was covering the Senate in the 70s and earlier. I try not to use a rosy rearview mirror. I don't want to suggest that we ever had a really distinguished Congress of statesmen. We didn't. But I think the percentage of really serious, independent people who think for themselves, read books, write their own speeches, and so on, has radically declined. I think this is going to be a problem for Barack Obama. We can talk about it in the discussion after I'm finished here. But there aren't enough bright people, and a lot of them, sadly, get frustrated. Chuck Hagel is a good example for me, who gave me some wonderful observations that are in the book. Hagel put up with it for two terms, but last year decided unceremoniously that he was giving up. He quit the Senate. It's too common, I'm afraid. The costs of these campaigns are really staggering. You here mostly know these numbers, but let me just repeat another of my favorite statistics, which I've used in the book. In 1974, not so long ago, it seems to me, although I guess it's longer than I want to recognize, the average winning Senate campaign, in other words, the campaign of the winner, running for the Senate that year, there were 33 or 34 of them, cost $450,000, $74. Today, that would be about $1.3 million. In November 08, the average winning campaign, we don't have the final numbers yet, but they're going to be very close to $10 million. And it's really quite stunning that in middle-sized states, North Carolina, Oregon, both those states, for example, had Senate campaigns that cost more than $40 million, all included. These are huge numbers. Money became more and more important in other ways, too. And this is what Norm's writing about today, Norm Ornstein. The city of Washington, in these years, luckily for some people like Carla, running businesses here, boomed and became prosperous in a way that those of us who grew up here never imagined we would see. More significant, I argue, Washington became a venue for the great American pastime, which is not baseball, but making money. Starting in the 60s, the reach of the federal government extended farther and farther into American society. More and more Americans realized that their own livelihoods, their own well-being could depend on decisions made in Washington. Corporations realized the same thing. It's interesting that when I was a young reporter in Washington, only a handful of big corporations had Washington offices. Today, they all do. And so, of course, to all the interest groups, many of which have been organized just during this period of time. And these are the people that hire lobbyists who have become a new class of wealthy, influential Washingtonians. This is where Jerry Cassidy came in. And I'll have a little bit at the end here to explain how I did what I did in this book, so that if and when you buy it, you won't be surprised by what you find. Soon, government officials, including lots of members of Congress, began to envy the big houses in Potomac, the big cars, the hunting lodges on the Eastern Shore, the big houses at Rehoboth, that this new class was acquiring. And as you know, thousands of people, literally thousands of former government officials, including nearly 200 former members of Congress, went through what we've come to know as the revolving door, cashed in on their public service to become lobbyists and strategic advisors, to use the term preferred by Senator Daschle. And to me, the eerie thing that's happened here, and I've written quite a lot about this, is that how this became normal. We used to have taboos in this town. There used to be things you just didn't do. I remember very well, I'm not going to come up with his name here, this is embarrassing, there was a very good liberal congressman from Michigan, it's in the book, who left Congress, and ran for the Senate in a primary against another guy. I'm not going to come up with the name.
It was Tim O'Hara then.
It was O'Hara, yeah. Not Tim, though. What's his name? Anyway, doesn't matter. He went to work. He lost the primary for the Senate, had to leave the House, had five or six children, and went to work for Tommy Boggs downtown. He was a lawyer, and he became a partner of the Boggs firm and became a lobbyist. And this was not looked on in a good way. People thought this was not quite the right thing to do. I quote Leon Panetta in the book, with whom I talked about this, saying, yeah, we all thought that was a bad choice he'd made. And in fact, he came up and tried to lobby people using his privileges on the floor, and I stayed away from him. I didn't want to talk to him. Jim O'Hara. And that was, he's died now, so I'm sorry to say. Anyway, that sort of thing was I think, the opening salvo in this situation. And here comes Tom Daschle now, 30 years later, 35 years later, driving around town in the back seat of a Cadillac and not thinking about, hey, maybe I'm earning, maybe this represents income of some kind. Maybe there's something untoward here that I ought to be paying attention to. I'm with Carla. I mean, Tom Daschle was a good guy. I did a profile of him a few years ago in the paper and thought he was an impressive public servant. But he fell into this. He fell into this situation where he thought, well, that's what everybody does now, you know. That's the way it's done. If you look at the list of the sources of his income, the $5 million that came out this week and last week, who he took speech fees from and who he took income from. I love the fact, this is a new feature in the modern age, that a law firm, Alston & Byrd, hired Senator Daschle. He came down and made $2 million plus from the law firm. Doesn't happen to be a lawyer, however. It's a little new. It's a new style. There are quite a few of them now, former members of Congress who are lobbyists or strategic advisors who have no law degrees but work in these lobbying law firms. Lobbyists. I'm sorry. The other thing that changed, another striking change, really, and I'm sure there are people in this room who can tell us, talk about it, is the motivation of people who want to work in the government. You go up on the Hill now and talk to people about who are the young people, or a few years ago, when I began this reporting in 2004, and this was easy to do then, when the Republicans were still in control, and not just on the Republican side, you go up and say, who are the young people who want to be on the staff? And overwhelmingly, it was young people who wanted to come for two or three or four years, punch a ticket, and then go downtown, as they say, and sign up as lobbyists. It was, a new game. It was a new way to go, extremely popular. I went to see Bob Strauss, who's been a good source and an interesting raconteur for many years for me. And I said, Strauss, explain to me, why has the lobbying business boomed so in the years that you've been in it? He thought about it for a minute. He said, well, you know, there's just so damn much money in it. I heard that phrase, and I knew that I had a title for my book. Now, to continue with my theory, lobbyists needed friends in Congress to win access and favors for their clients. Members of Congress needed money to run for re-election. And the rest is history. One of my favorite quotations in the book is from Dale Liebach, a very talented Washington PR guy who once worked for Jerry Cassidy. And Dale said this, his analysis of the situation, quote, the Hill, Congress, can't exist without downtown, which is the jargon used to describe K Street or the lobbying community, and downtown can't exist without the Hill. It's the largest, most democratic bazaar in the world, and it's all about money going in both directions. In Congress, it became commonplace to swap your vote or give away your time in a trade for favors for your constituents or your supporters. There was a vivid example of this in September, which I think didn't get enough attention. After the House initially defeated the big bailout bill, and we all lost a lot of money on the stock market as a result, all of us who were lucky enough to have stocks or unlucky enough, It was a disastrous turn of events for the administration and for the leadership in Congress, and so quickly sweeteners were added to the bill. Such a revealing word, sweeteners, a great Washington word. One was an extension of a tax break for distillers of Puerto Rican rum. Cost $192 million to the Treasury. Another was a tax break for the owners of stock car racetracks, $100 million. Another was a tax break for movie makers who shoot their films inside the USA. No foreign filmmakers, only the good domestic ones. A $478 million tax break over 10 years. These and a few others did the trick the second time around, and the collapse of the stock market, to be fair, the second time around, the bill passed. Sweeteners were payoffs, really. At least that's my position. They're a lot like the earmarks that John McCain ran against last fall. The chief character in my book, Jerry Cassidy, was one of the inventors of the modern earmark. This was a surprise to me. I didn't realize it when I started my reporting that this was the case, but it's true. And for an amazing time in the late 80s and the early 90s, the Cassidy firm was the only one in town that really knew how to do this. And it just made an enormous amount of money doing it. That was the start of Jerry's $100 million fortune. When the Republicans gained control of the Congress in 94, also a too little noted phenomenon, they turned to earmarks as a principal tool to keep their majority, to stay in office. And there's, I guess, some wonderful stuff from Bob Livingston, who was the chairman who Newt Gingrich picked to be the chairman of the Appropriations Committee from 95 onward. Livingston, who had to resign himself, you know this story from when he got into trouble later. But Livingston reports that Gingrich would come to him and say, you've got to give this bridge to Jones. Jones really needs some help at home. You've got to give this other thing to Smith. Smith needs some help at home. Livingston was quite a good legislator, in my opinion, and a pretty good public servant. Didn't like this, but he said, this was my leader. He was put me in power as the chairman. I had to do what he said. Gingrich was the leading promoter of earmarks for members. When you hear him pontificating about government spending next time, keep that in mind. The Republicans, of course, also cultivated Republican lobbyists. This was the famous K Street Project. Favors flew in both directions. And it's quite extraordinary. David Maris and Michael Weisskopf wrote an absolutely fabulous series in the Post about this. I've stolen from it liberally in the book just to remind people about the way DeLay turned over the much of the job of running the House to lobbyists and corporate interests whose favor he was happy to curry. To be fair, the ideologies were the same. There was a definite pro-business bent among the Republican leaders, but in the end, lobbyists got to write bills, get favors, do extraordinary things. And they played their part. They gave millions and millions of dollars and raised millions and millions of dollars to keep the Republicans in power, and it worked for a very long time. Was this corrupt? Russell Long, years ago in the early 70s, made a wonderful statement. There's just a hairline's difference, he said, between a campaign contribution and a bribe. Jack Abumoff, after he got caught and got into trouble, told people he knew that he had been a participant in a system of legalized bribery. I think that's not a bad description. I ran by a number of people. Panetta interested me. And 2 years ago, had lunch with Leon here in town. I said, Abramoff said it was legalized bribery. Is that too strong? Absolutely not. He said it's been legalized bribery around here for a long time. That's the problem. Leon Panetta, interesting source. And in Washington, this is all rationalized away. I just very quickly, it's in the book, but this has really intrigued me. I was born here. I've lived here for 6 decades. I thought I understood everything that went on in Washington. One thing I discovered, which I had heard of but had no sense of whatsoever when I was doing the reporting here, is the burgeoning Washington fundraising consulting industry. It's become another, like the political consulting industry, like the lobbying industry. It's one of our big booming enterprises now. I met a wonderful guy called Mike Fraioli, who runs a firm for Democrats, who explained this to me, what they do. If you're running for Congress or the Senate now, if you have a serious race, almost inevitably you hire one of these consultants. If you hire Fraioli, he will give you lists of people who have contributed either to you in the past or to people with voting records like yours or people who share your interests and your objectives. And your job is to call them. And the stunning thing that Riley told me was that today's members of Congress typically devote one day a week or more, one full day a week or more, to dialing for dollars, sitting around. They can't do it from their offices. You remember Al Gore got in trouble for that. You've got to go over to one of the partisan campaign committees or somewhere else, and you go through the list that Mike has given you and you call. What a demeaning experience. Here are these senators of the United States calling these people one after another. And Mike says to me, you know, a lot of them hang up on you. A lot of them say no. A lot of them are ruder than that. And the senator's there, you know, here he goes, one after another. This is, of course, something they don't want to talk about because it is demeaning. It doesn't seem like an appropriately senatorial way to go. I think it's one of the many corrosive effects of all this. As I wrote on Sunday, I think, you know, we have something interesting going on with a president, a new president who understands this. And really, I give him credit as an anthropologist. He figured out this culture of Washington, and he's taken some steps already to deal with it. And I think probably not going through with the Daschle appointment will prove to be a rather significant moment here, or could do. But we'll have to see. And I'm happy to talk about this more if you want to when we have some questions in a minute. I just quickly want to tell you what I did here and tell you what this book is to avoid an unfair surprise. I set out on a classic reporter's mission in my own mind, which was to find out how it works and to deconstruct a term that I myself had used many times and heard many times, but had realized 5-6 years ago that I didn't really understand the term was Washington lobbyist. So I set out as a storyteller to find somebody who I could use as a personage, a leading character, who would help me tell the story, make it interesting, give it a human dimension, and make it fun. I started asking around, talking to people. I remembered Cassidy from these stories that we did at the Post when I was the national editor in the 80s, and my wonderful colleague Dan Morgan discovered Cassidy's earmarking business, and we exposed it in the Washington Post. But he was one of a number of people on my mind. And another wonderful colleague, now a former colleague, retired Chuck Babcock, told me that I should go to the Securities and Exchange Commission and look at the S-1 that Cassidy filed in the late 90s. I said, what's an S-1? I know now. And he said, that's the form that you have to file if you propose to take a company public. It's a description of the business. It's meant to be an explanation of why anyone would want to invest in the business. And Cassidy had indeed had this idea that he would be the first lobbying firm to be publicly owned. And to his credit, he did a very honest and thorough job. He published an extremely interesting, detailed description of his business and how it worked. It was so good that I'm really quite sure that a number of competitors that came into his business, his earmark business later, stole technique from this filing. I went to Cassidy. I told him I'd read this document, and it was so interesting and gave me such a head start as a reporter that I was going to use him as my guy. I was going to find out everything I could about him and everything I could about his business. He obviously wasn't thrilled with this news, although it's interesting. It's a great case of the, you know, ego is a big thing in Washington, and he was flattered, I think, to some degree that I was interested in him and wanted to do this, but he was wary too. I said, I'm not going to ask you for anything for months. So I went off for most of a year and did a lot of reporting. Talked to lots of people from other early phases of his life. By the time I came back to him, he had picked up on the fact that I was doing a pretty thorough job. Eventually, he decided that he would be better off, under advice from his colleague, Jody Powell, who he hired and made a rich man. That's a good story that's in the book, which I won't try to do justice to now. But Jody told him, I think correctly, that this may not be good, but it'll be better if you talk to him than if you don't. And I'm sure that was true. I hope I have been sympathetic to Cassidy as a human being. Carla mentioned his youth. He came from a really miserable, drunken, impoverished Irish childhood in Red Hook in Brooklyn. He's the first member of his family to go to college, the first to go to law school. He had this extraordinary ambition and determination. I call him a Jay Gatsby for modern Washington. But he did it. He pulled it off. It's quite a remarkable life story. But so I, I, you know, I, I tried to follow the history of the business. It's not, no one lobbying firm or one lobbyist could be representative of all. He's unusual in many respects, but also typical in others. And his story was a very good vehicle, I thought, for telling the story of how Washington became a profit center, how people started to learn to make money in Washington. Cassidy himself eventually sold his firm 3 times. It's an incredible story. Twice to an employee stock ownership plan, and then ultimately to the Interpublic group of companies. He cashed in a very big way, just did extremely well. But in the course of this reporting, I realized that I was on to something much more than lobbying. I was on to this theory, which I began my talk with, trying to explain to you the interconnection of absolutely everything. I've been thinking of this as Kaiser's theory of everything. You'll have to test it out by reading the book if you're interested. But that was my effort here, was to say that we can't really appreciate what's happened and the sad bad effects of it if we don't see that all these things operated and affected each other. Now it's a book of stories, and I'm going longer than I should, but I love this one story so much that I want to read it to you, and it'll give you a sense of how I went about doing this. One of my favorite sources for the reporting was Ray Strother, the wonderful Louisiana-born political consultant, very interesting character, a very independent guy, who is written a wonderful book himself. Did you ever have him here?
Yeah.
It's unfortunately published by the University of Louisiana Press and didn't get a lot of attention, but it's a wonderful book. Strother was retained by two of his previous clients, Russell Long and Lloyd Benson, in 1982 to help their friend John Stennis, who found himself in trouble. And that's what this story is about. And let me just quickly read a little bit about it. Stennis was first elected to the Senate in a special election in 1947. He was facing re-election for the sixth time in 1982. He had never raised more than $5,000 for any previous campaign. And since his first victory, he had never faced a serious opponent. In 1982, a 34-year-old Republican activist, who we well know here, named Haley Barbour, decided that he would challenge Stennis. Ronald Reagan had swept Mississippi in 1980. Republicans had taken control of the Senate, and they were eager now to knock off vulnerable Democrats. They put the 81-year-old Stennis in that category. Now, Stennis, many of the people here know about Stennis. He was a mixed bag. He was a terrible Mississippi racist on all the race issues, but he was also a very interesting and distinguished character in the world that he cared the most about, which was the Armed Services Committee and Defense Appropriations. And he was also a strong believer in ethics, and he was the first chairman of the Senate Ethics Committee, had a very interesting record in any case. Stennis's friends among the old bulls in the Senate were nervous about what might happen. So I tell Long and Benson hired Strother and sent him to Mississippi to check out the scene. Strother realized that Barbour's campaign would try to convince Mississippians that Stennis was too old and too frail to serve another term. Strother's plan was to undermine that argument with TV commercials that would feature testimonials from Stennis's colleagues and carefully made spots featuring the senator himself looking perfectly competent. This would cost serious money, Strother told the senator when they met one day in his office in the Senate in the Russell Building. We'd have to raise at least $2 million. How, the old man asked, could he do that? Benson and Long had volunteered to raise some of the money, Strother explained, but Stennis would have to help. When Strother talked about this, he wrote later in his book, Stennis, quote, would just wring his hands. Finally, in desperation, I reminded the old senator that he was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, that he had served separately on the Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense, and that he had spent billions of dollars with the defense industry on weapon systems that had been approved in those committees. What about LTV, I asked him. What about McDonnell Douglas? In other words, Strother was telling Stennis it was time to cash in some chits with the corporations that got rich on the Pentagon programs that Stennis had long supported. Would that be proper? Senator Stennis asked. And then he answered the question himself, addressing Strother the way he addressed most grown men as sir. Quote, I hold life and death over those companies. I don't think it would be proper for me to take money from them. Personally, Strother agreed, but he told his client that this was, quote, how all the other senators do it now. His reassurance, quote, did not salve his feelings that it was wrong, Struthers remembered in an interview with me. Stennis's question has bothered me for years, Struthers said 25 years later. I'll never forget that conversation or the troubled look on his lined face. When I left his office, he was looking at his folded hands on the table in his office that had once belonged to Harry S. Truman. It looked as though he was in prayer. I was very sad. I had just diminished something he held very dear. It was obvious he thought I was telling him to sell his vote for campaign money. The money was raised, the commercials were made and broadcast. Stennis thumped Barber by nearly 2-1. He served out his seventh term and retired in 1989 at 87. More such stories right in here. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. In the book, do you suggest what we can do about this, or is the toothpaste out of the tube and can't be put back in?
Good question. It's interesting. Carla's husband, David, and Fred Wertheimer, his old colleague, and other people of that crowd of reformers actually have a pretty short list of things that can be done. They all share one thing in common. It's hard to imagine them ever happening. But Fred and David and others remain absolutely optimistic and determined that they could do something about this. And it isn't that hard. What we have is a culture. Cultures respond to stimuli. My epigraph for the whole book is the wonderful, oft-used Plunkett of Tammany Hall, George Washington Plunkett. I seen my opportunities, and I took them. And that's for me, that's the whole story here. Just like Tom Daschle, he's seen his opportunities when this guy comes and says, don't you want a fat deal like this? And he decided, sure, why not? Everybody does it. So I won't try to do justice to the whole list here. There's three pages or four pages of them in the last chapter, which has the prescient title, if I say so myself, a corroded culture. But they're there. They involve public financing campaigns and a lot more of transparency about lobbyist contacts with officials. For example, in the Internet age, it would be quite simple to have a rule that said every time an executive branch official or a Capitol Hill member or staffer met with a lobbyist, she or he had to report that the same day on the Internet. Who'd you see? What was the subject discussed? Etc. That would be really cool, I think. It could have a big impact. Of course, it would be cool because it would be great for reporters, but it would be fun and effective, too. But it's doable. Free television ads. It's all here. You can read the menu. But it's, you know, whether it'll happen, I have no idea. And what we're living through right now, you know, I mean, it's so interesting. Obama does this executive order. It's quite a good executive order. Fred Wertheimer calls it the best thing that's been done in many, many years in Washington. And then he immediately says, but we have to have waivers. And then they pick this guy, William Lynn, who I don't know anything about. He may be wonderful. But I know a number of other candidates for the job of Deputy Secretary of Defense who have never been lobbyists. Why he had to have Lynn, I don't know. But so there's immediately a waiver for the Raytheon lobbyist to be the Deputy Secretary of Defense. So there we are.
Thank you. Good evening. I haven't read your book yet, but it seems
it's not too late.
I purchased it, though.
Sure.
I see a similarity, perhaps, with The Appeal by Grisham, which you may or may not have read?
Yeah, I have not.
Okay, well, in that one, the lobbyists win. And as I was reading the book, I wondered if there was perhaps an alternate ending, and I wonder if you foresee any alternate ending to us in the United States.
Well, you've made me think I better buy that book before I leave tonight, because that sounds intriguing. I'm not a Grisham reader, I confess, but that's fun. You know, one of the things about lobbying is how much baloney there is in it. I've got a wonderful story that I love about a campaign that Cassidy was the orchestrator of to save the Seawolf submarine. The Seawolf was a fabulous weapon system, which we still have a few of. We only made three, I guess. And one of them is used as a spy ship very effectively now. But it was designed to fight the Soviet Navy in the North Atlantic, and George H.W. Bush and Dick Cheney, the Secretary of Defense, realized in 92 that this was too expensive, and they proposed to rescind it, to do a rescission and get rid of it. And Cassidy got involved. I won't try to do the whole thing here, but what I realized when I talked to everybody, Tom Dodd and Joe Lieberman and Claiborne Pell and the sadly deceased former Republican Senator John Chafee from Rhode Island, really saved the Seawolf with the help of the Navy, which actively undermined its civilian bosses on the Hill to win support for it. But Cassidy and Jody Powell, who ran this, the PR side of this, and their whole group, ran this very elaborate, very well done, very sophisticated public relations campaign. And to many of the participants and to General Dynamics, the company that hired them, it looked like, hey, these guys did a great job. And in a way, they did do a great job. But I argue in the book that it had almost no effect on the outcome. And a great deal of lobbying is like that. One of my favorite quotes is from a guy who unfortunately wouldn't let me put his name on this quote for competitive reasons, I guess. But a big guy in a big Washington lobbying firm, he said, I always tell my associates, when it rains, dance. In other words, you're the rainmaker, you're the influential one. If you're lucky enough to be out in a rainstorm, make sure you get credit for it. This is an absolutely basic part of the lobbying business. So, in other words, sometimes they appear to win when they didn't do anything. Yes, I think that the society can win, that we can beat this back. We can't eliminate lobbying and shouldn't, and that's an important thing to say. The First Amendment protects the right of citizens to petition the government for redress of grievances. That's lobbying. The Red Cross has a lobbyist. Lots of good guys have lobbyists. It's not, per se, a horrible profession, and all the people in it are not horrible people. A lot of them are fine people. And so it's too easy to be glib about it. But I don't think we're sunk here, but we have to face up to what's happened, which is, I guess, the real mission of writing a book like this, is to say, hey, folks, look in the mirror and see what we are. I have a line in here that we're a town and a society that prefers our myths to our realities. I fervently believe that. And I'm trying to give you the realities here.
Thanks for your book and talk. I'm afraid I'm a lobbyist.
Don't be fearful.
For
well, maybe this crowd. I don't know.
though I'm a lobbyist for campaign finance reform, working with a group of Americans for campaign reform, which is trying to overhaul the campaign finance system. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit to one important dimension that has emerged more in the last election in particular, which is a growing role of small donors, citizen donors to campaigns, and what role that might play in a revamped public campaign finance system.
It's a very important question. Just as the importance of money in politics changed everything in the 35 or so years that I'm writing about here, I think the Internet is again about to change everything. And it does offer many promising opportunities. I don't want to get burdened with a technical discussion about how to do this, but curious people here should go to the Democracy 21 website, which is Fred Wertheimer's website, and read his proposal, which is his idea is to enshrine the small givers as the most important people, to organize a federal funding system based on how many small contributions the candidates get, put new limits on the size of the fat cat, make them able to give less than they can give now, and to generally promote this idea. This election, which we're just, there'll be some books about it, and it'll be reverberating for a long time. But Obama found something entirely new. I bet there's some of the people in this room are part of it. I know there are members of my family who were getting constantly dunned by the great Obama machine. I don't know how much they gave. I gave nothing. But Obama raised half the money that he spent from small contributors. But he raised half the money he spent from other contributors, too, and he spent $800 million. That is a lot of money. And that's another example to me of the kind of ambiguity of all the right and wrongs here. And will he be able to lead a crusade, ultimately, to change this system when he found a way to benefit from it so enormously himself? I just don't know, but it's intriguing. Thank you very much. This is great.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.